Hi, this is Doug Henwood. This is an unusual truncated edition of Behind the News. When they originally broadcast on May 14th, the last 20 minutes or so of the show were devoted to fundraising for KPFA, where this program originates. I didn't think that people on the web would want to listen to that, so I excised that from this internet version. But please, even though I've excised it, please consider making a pledge to KPFA and keep this experiment in community broadcasting alive for another 60 years. If there are no KPFA, there will be no Behind the News. And if you like it and want to keep it going, then make that pledge. KPFA.org. You can do so securely on the web, and no one will steal your credit card numbers or anything. So if you like what you hear, please do contribute to KPFA.org. And now to the original show and the interview with Deepa Kumar as broadcast on May 14th. Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today is a fundraising show. I'm taking a bit of a risk, not building it around a sensational premium. Instead, the first part of this show will consist of just the sort of interview you're likely to hear on any regular edition of Behind the News. Today's is with Deepa Kumar, a professor at Rutgers, who is writing a book on political Islam. With the uprisings in the Middle East and the assassination of Osama bin Laden, we've been hearing a lot of stuff about Islamic fundamentalism, or whatever you want to call it exactly. But it's highly likely that if you heard it or read it in the big-time media, it's somewhere between a half-truth and a no-truth. It's a virtual certainty it went by in a flash. That's the nature of the big media. Among other things, it doesn't want to do anything to challenge the assumptions of the dominant discourse. It loves what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu called in his wonderful little book On Television, that's both its title and its subject. He called them fast thinkers. They're the kind of thinkers, using that term loosely, that simply reinforce convention, maybe with a little spice of sensation added. Anything else, anything unusual or critical, would interrupt the flow of the medium. And that's something that advertisers hate. Not here, though. Not KPFA or Behind the News. We've got time and the inclination to challenge the dominant discourse. So I hope you'll listen and then be inspired to contribute to KPFA. Not because I'm offering some splendid merchandise, but because you like what you hear every week on Behind the News and also during the 167 other hours every week on KPFA. More on all that a little later. Before we listen to Deepa Kumar, a couple of words on the European economic crisis. There were rumors circulating last week, prompted by a story in the German news magazine Der Spiegel, that Greece was contemplating an exit from the Eurozone, meaning a rejection of that common currency and a return to its old national unit, the drachma. Trying to clarify what was going on, I contacted the Athens-based economist Yanis Varoufakis, who's been on the show several times over the last few years. Yanis told me, and I'm sorry we didn't have time for a full interview, that the story in Der Spiegel was planted by sources within Germany trying to get that country's government to wake up to the fact that the whole debt strategy, which means basically squeezing the debtors for every cent they owe, isn't working. The Greek economy continues to contract, and unemployment continues to rise. The harder the creditors squeeze, the worse the collapse. There's just no way that Greece or other troubled debtors in the periphery of Europe can pay 100 cents on the euro, which means that there will have to be write-offs, some form of debt relief, and a return to growth on the periphery that debt relief would presumably stimulate. The exiting the euro strategy was meant to scare Angela Merkel, the German leader, into alertness. Some people, like Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, have argued that Greece should leave the eurozone. Yanis says this is a bad idea. The moment that Greece announced the return of the drachma, every ATM in Greece would be emptied by people trying to protect their savings. The run of the banks would lead to total collapse almost instantaneously. That's because it's almost certain that the new drachma would quickly lose its value against the euro, which would not only wipe out Greek savings, but greatly increase the burden of the country's debts, which is why there would be a run on euros while they were available. The debts are denominated in euros, so the collapse in the drachma would make the real debt burden that much higher. Really, the only policy that makes any sense is some sort of debt relief, but so far Germany, the major creditor and major political power in Europe, is not playing along. Okay, a musical break and then Deepa Kumar. We'll be right back. That was some of Getting Older by the New Zealand band The Clean. My guest today, before the fundraising appeal begins, is Deepa Kumar, a professor of media studies at Rutgers and author of Outside the Box, Corporate Media, Globalization, and the UPS Strike. She's now working on a book on political Islam and its role in Middle Eastern politics. The first part of her two-part article on that subject is available on the web at the International Socialist Review site, isreview.org. There's a link to her piece right in the front page, and it's well worth reading. That's isreview.org. Deepa Kumar. Welcome, Deepa. There's a certain strand of thinking in the West that Islam is deeply political. It always has been. It's a warrior religion bent on conquest or beheading. And you know, we're very familiar with the clash of civilizations rhetoric. This is really, really a gross misrepresentation of actual history, isn't it?
Absolutely. Actually, if you look at the history of Islam and if you look at the history of various Muslim empires, the trajectory of the religion hasn't really been that different from what's happened in Christianity, which is there's been a separation between the religion and the political spheres. And this is really out of political necessity. I mean, if you look at the 9th, 10th century and so on, various Shia dynasties would cooperate with Sunni dynasties, would cooperate with the West against each other and so forth. And this really had to do with political pragmatism. It was not about religion and Islam in particular motivating their actions, but more about, you know, what does each empire, what does each kingdom need to do and so forth. So really historically, if you look at, you know, after the 7th century, after the Prophet Muhammad, who founded the religion, passes on, all of his successors, there's always been a separation between the people who held religious authority, these are the caliphs, these are the ulema, versus the political leaderships, the emirs, the sultans, and so on. And they've operated in two different spheres. And by the way, from about the 8th century on, the religious sphere has always been subordinate to the political sphere.
Now, Islam has no hierarchy. There is no Vatican. So how does that relate to its relation to politics?
In part, people look at that aspect of Islam to say that that is the reason why there has not been sort of clashes in the way that there were clashes between the Vatican, the papacy, and various other institutions in society. That is to say, it wasn't an organized force with this sort of apparatus that could wield power in that way. But at the same time, you know, it's not to, I don't want to go to the other extreme to say that religion has not played a role in various Muslim-majority countries and Muslim societies. The role that it has played is largely in social and political life. And in that, in those spheres, you know, the ulama, the religious scholars, and so on, have sort of dictated what kinds of social mores and rules and so on people should live by. But you don't have the equivalent of the kind of hierarchical, you know, apparatus like the Vatican with the Pope at the top.
I think some modern Islamists and also people who are afraid of them, like Glenn Beck, have a fantasy of the recreation of a caliphate. Is there any kind of historical basis for this kind of a fantasy of a Muslim empire?
Well, here's the history of it. Ever since Islam comes into being as a religion in the 7th century, what you saw is that the first Muslim army, as a way to both consolidate political as well as political power as well as religious influence, goes up against the two main empires at the time, the Persian Empire and the Byzantine Empire. And over the course of about a century, they take over large parts of the territories that belong to these two empires. And the reason is simple. It's because these two empires, the Byzantine and the Persian, had been at war with each other for over a century, and the people had grown tired of this constant warfare. As a result, when the Muslim armies came in, very often the villagers welcomed them, and when they set up a new kingdom, they actually gave them religious freedom. That is, they gave them a choice. They said, you either convert to Islam or you stick with your religion and you pay a fine. So in other words, there has been, you know, it is the case that the Muslim armies over the course of the next few centuries after Muhammad would go on to form powerful Muslim empires all the way from Spain to India. But here's the part that gets left out. The part that gets left out is that if you look at Andalusian Spain, this was a period where you had magnificent cooperation between Muslims, Christians, Jews, and so forth. And there are many centers of learning that come into being in Andalusian Spain, where you see cooperation between scholars of various religious backgrounds and so on. And there was also a lot of respect between, that Muslim rulers and Muslim administrators had for Christians and for Jews, and this is because Islam actually recognizes these religions as legitimate, as, you know, sort of previous avatars of Islam, and therefore legitimate and worthy of respect and so forth. So the idea that, you know, of this crusading Muslim army that wants to suppress everyone and keep them down and so on is not borne out by the history of tolerance that you've seen in various Muslim empires all the way from the 8th to the 20th century.
Now, you write of a division of labor between the men of the pen and the men of the sword. What's that about?
Yes. Essentially, in the context of these large Muslim empires, what happens is that it's no longer possible for one leader to both be the religious and social leader as well as to also be the political leader, because, in fact, the political sphere needed autonomy from the religious sphere, you know, needed to actually be able to do whatever it needed to do in order to establish empire. And so what you see is, for the first time, the bringing together of scholars to actually create the Sharia, which is a set of rules codified into law, having to do with everything, all spheres of life.
What period are we talking about?
We are talking about the 8th, 9th, 10th century. So this is a long, long time back, and the first Muslim empires, if you will, what they did is they brought together large numbers of people from various regions, and what they needed was a set of laws that could be applied uniformly to all Muslim subjects. And so this became the basis for a system of organization known as Sharia. And of course, there's no one Sharia. There are different Sharia laws. And these laws essentially encompassed everything from rules relating to marriage, divorce, property, hygiene, even commerce, crime, et cetera, et cetera. And so what you see is that's the basis of Sharia law. But the men of pen, that is the people who are the administrative, social organizers, this is the religious branch of the Islamic religion. These are the men of pen. They hold authority over the social and the political sphere in terms of how people will live their life. But the people who go about making war, the people who administer politically and so on, the men of sword, they operate by a different set of rules. And one thing that's really clear is that the political sphere has always been the stronger of the two. The religious sphere, the men of pen, as it were, served at the behest of the political leadership.
And much of the Muslim world was colonized by various European powers. What effect did that have on the religion and its relation to political power?
Essentially, you had a period from about the 8th century till about the 17th, 18th century when the various Muslim empires all over the region are dominant. They're dominant not just politically, but they're dominant economically. They're dominant in the realm of culture and ideas. Keep in mind that Europe is going through what's called the Dark Ages. That dynamic shifts towards the 17th, 18th century, when Europe, going through the process of capitalist development, gives various European nations some advantage over, for instance, the Ottoman dynasty, which had, you know, had been ruling for several centuries. And so what you see is European colonial powers start to make incursions into various parts of the Muslim world, into the Ottoman Empire, into parts of the Egyptian Empire's territories, the Persian Empire. And the rulers at the top of these societies start to realize that if they're going to push back against colonial incursion, they're going to have to develop, they're going to have to modernize, they're going to have to institute capitalist reforms in order to have, first and foremost, the military might by which they can stand up against colonial incursion. And one of the sort of leading figures in this is the Egyptian ruler Mehmet Ali, who essentially recognized that, he needed a modernized army, and therefore the Industrial Revolution he really grasped the significance of the Industrial Revolution, and he recognized that he'd need a modernized army with textile factories to make, you know, tents and uniforms, munitions factories to produce guns. And, of course, what you see with this process of modernization and a shift towards, you know, capitalist forms of industry and so on is a wholesale secularization of these societies. The introduction of schools, the introduction of, you know, modern secular institutions. And what happens in that process is that the ulema, the religious scholars who used to hold hegemony in the social and religious spheres, they start losing their power, and instead you see an educated, modern middle class that starts to replace them in functions in the government and social roles.
And did Islam have any role in any kind of anti-colonial agitation in the region?
Yes. Now, what you see is that in response to colonialism, there are various movements, if you will, from below. I said earlier that there's an attempt by the rulers of the Egyptian dynasty of, you know, the Ottomans and so on, to adopt processes of modernization and so forth. But from the bottom up as well, there are people who start to organize. A very minor part of the bottom up, if you will, anti-colonial movement is the Islamic revivalist movement led by this one individual, Jamal al-Din al-Afghani, and his descendants, ideological descendants, Muhammad Abdu, Rashid Ridda, and so on. And essentially they see what colonialism is doing to their societies, and what they say is that the solution to this, the way in which these Muslim societies can regain the power that they used to have and the prestige, is to go back to the founding texts of Islam, which is the Quran and the Sunnah and so on. And so that's what they advocate. They lay down what are the basic principles of Salafist thought. But keep in mind, there's a huge difference between Salafist thought as it was advocated by these founders and Salafism today. What these people were talking about is essentially a return to the traditions of the religious community that surrounded the Prophet Muhammad. That's what the Salaf is. It's the religious community that surrounded the Prophet. And also it's interesting that Afghani was actually a modernizer at the same time as he was advocating a return to the past. But today's Salafists are completely reactionary. They are out-and-out reactionary. So at any rate, this was one trend among several that emerged in the 19th century as a way to push back against colonialism. But the key thing to keep in mind is that we shouldn't overemphasize their part. Because even though today people look at al-Afghani as being influential and, if you will, a founding father of Islamist thought, their ideas were really, really marginal. The key people organizing against colonialism really were the secular nationalists. And it is they who had the support of the vast majority of people in various countries.
I'm Sukhav Deepa Kumar of Rutgers University, is also the author of a piece in the International Socialist Review on political Islam. And you mentioned the secular nationalists. There are also some Marxists leading anti-colonialist forces, which create a lot of anxiety in the Western capitals, Washington and London and elsewhere. So what was their reaction when they saw what they thought was an impossible set of forces beginning to fight against their domination?
Essentially, radical secular nationalism really begins in the post-Second World War period. And here we're talking about people like Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. And if you look at the U.S.'s attitudes towards these secular nationalist leaders, and you've got to put this in historic context, at first they try to co-opt them, they try to bring them into the Western fold and so on, and when that doesn't work, when they realize they can't make these people, you know, client regimes, the U.S. turns against them. Why? Because if you look at the immediate period after the Second World War, after the First World War, oil as a key energy resource linked to security becomes quite established. Lord Curzon, I believe, said that, I'll paraphrase him, he said that the Allies floated to victory on a sea of oil. And certainly after the Second World War, this became very important as well. And so the U.S. develops a strategy, which some people refer to as the post-war petroleum order, which is connecting the cheap oil from the Middle East and North Africa to Europe. The Marshall Plan, as it was, you know, conceived, was a way in which to rebuild a war-destroyed Europe after the Second World War. And the way this was going to happen is through cheap oil and cheap energy resources coming from the Middle East. What that means is a set of relationships between not just oil-producing countries, but countries that also, you know, are the key transportation routes as well. You know, like the Suez Canal is very important to transport oil to the Middle East. So the U.S.'s vision at this time is how to get this oil out as, you know, efficiently as possible, which means that any president, any head of state that went against the U.S.'s plan would automatically become an enemy. And so Nasser, for instance, after he, you know, refuses to comply with what the U.S. wants to do, this, we're talking here in the 50s, he becomes the key symbol of everything that the U.S. despises in the region. And there's everything from attempts to poison his chocolates, his cigars, and so on, to, of course, the most strategic orientation that the U.S. has, which is backing the Islamists against the secular nationalists. And this is true not just in Egypt, where they backed the Muslim Brotherhood, but even in Iran. The CIA overthrows Mossadegh. Mossadegh is democratically elected, but he makes the mistake, that is from the point of view of the U.S., of nationalizing the oil industry and actually using the resources, with the plan to use the resources for Iranians themselves. And, of course, the U.S. wouldn't have that. They depose him. But in doing so, they use the forces associated with Khomeini, particularly Khomeini's mentor. So that's been sort of the trajectory, is in order to keep oil flowing smoothly, prop up dictators and go against secular nationalists and progressive forces.
And Saudi Arabia played a crucial role in this too, didn't it?
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia has really been central to the U.S.'s Islam policy. Essentially, the U.S.'s strategy of promoting Islam on the political stage against secular nationalism and against the left in the Middle East and North Africa begins in the 1950s with Eisenhower. And essentially, Eisenhower and his doctrine, the Eisenhower Doctrine, it's about a number of things, but one part of it is to prop up King Saud of Saudi Arabia as an alternative pole of attraction to Nasser. Keep in mind that Nasser and what he calls Arab socialism is fantastically influential in the region at this time, you know, in ways similar to what's happening right now, right? The Egyptian revolution has served as sort of the inspiration point for people's movements in Yemen, in Syria, in Bahrain, and so forth. And so similarly, you know, Nasserism at the time was very much a sort of model for people to emulate in the Arab world. So anyway, the United States looks to King Saud to sort of form an alternative pole of attraction. And, of course, they're not successful because, you know, King Saud has no legitimacy in the region. But nevertheless, over the course of the next few decades, what the Saudi ruling elite would do is they would, first of all, set up, you know, use their petrodollars to set up this network of charity and good works and so on, which, by the way, becomes very important in the context of the 1970s economic crisis and the turn towards neoliberalism, because when governments no longer are willing to subsidize things like food and, you know, all sorts of things that these governments once used to do, which under neoliberalism is now seen as, you know, no-go, the charitable networks become really important ways in which people can sustain themselves. Additionally, Saudi Arabia would set up several political umbrella groups like the World Muslim League, the Islamic Conference, and so on. And most importantly, Saudi Arabia sets up a financial system which is able to supply various Islamist organizations with the money that they need to vie for political hegemony.
And the Chicago Boys even had a connection in the Middle East, didn't they?
Absolutely. Essentially, what you see happening is that with the spike in oil prices, this banking system, the Islamic banking system as it's called, gets set up. And of course, the people who set it up don't necessarily have the resources to oversee this entirely different banking system. And of course, the key players who come in the United States are the Chicago School, University of Chicago, Milton Friedman, who's the neoliberal guru, and all of his students. And in addition, and they're not the only ones. If they provided some of the, if you will, the technological, the financial know-how and the ideology, you also have banks like Citibank, Chase Manhattan, as well as others like Price Waterhouse, Goldman Sachs, and so on, all involved in bringing into being this Islamic banking system based entirely on the neoliberal model. And, of course, most people don't know this, but it's this banking system that would give the funds and the money necessary for Islamist organizations to vie for power, particularly in the period after the late 60s and 70s when secular nationalism begins a process of decline.
The Saudi thing is very interesting because, you know, much of the financing for the so-called terror networks comes through Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden himself is Saudi. The 9/11 hijackers were Saudis. Yet George Bush walks around holding hands with their leaders. Well, why do the Saudis get such a free pass?
Yes. The relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is what people have called oil for security, right? Saudi Arabia houses the greatest supply of oil in the world, I believe 25% of known oil resources. And what makes it even more attractive, of course, is it's easily extractable. It's not terribly expensive to attract. And so from the early 30s on, this was almost, you know, as soon as the Saudi state was established as a state, the U.S. has had a relationship with that country, even before oil was discovered. And at that point, the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia was one where the U.S. is trying to intervene in the Middle East, trying to get a piece of the oil pie, if you want to call it that. But it's Britain that actually has a control over oil resources. And so part of the way in which they avoid going through Britain is they form a direct relationship with Saudi Arabia. And, of course, oil is struck about a decade later, and Saudi Arabia becomes extremely important. Since then, I mentioned oil for security. Essentially, the U.S. doesn't so much want oil for domestic consumption. I think when I last checked, it was number five in terms of domestic consumption. The U.S. gets oil from North Africa and other places and so on, but it's more about controlling the spigot and setting the terms of who will get oil at what price. And so the U.S. wants oil, and Saudi Arabia wants security. And that security means security both against external threats, which is what Saddam Hussein was perceived as being in 91, as well as internal threats, which is all threats that include calls for democracy, workers' rights, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, in the late 40s and the mid-50s, there was a series of strikes in the eastern oil-rich provinces, and Aramco, the Arab American Oil Corporation, was instrumental in getting the names of strike leaders and organizers to the government so that they could, you know, imprison them, deport them, torture them, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the rubric of this relationship, and it's worked for the most part. You know, there have been one or two moments that where they've bumped up against each other, but for the most part, it's a seven-decade solid relationship. Now, it became a little bit uncomfortable after 9/11 when it was discovered that the majority of the hijackers were actually of Saudi origin. And so publicly, at least, there was a need to renounce, you know, to denounce, if you will, the Saudi connection to Al-Qaeda as well as to the existing Salafists and so forth. But let's not forget that when this financing actually through a bank, which I believe is the BCCI, it was first established in the context of the U.S. funding the Mujahideen or the Holy Warriors in Afghanistan to fight the proxy war against the Soviet Union. And that, and the sending of money and the sending of funneling of resources was actually set up at the behest of the CIA. So when Saudi, you know, millionaires and billionaires and so on were courted to give money to the Mujahideen, it was the U.S. that oversaw banking, you know, in terms of banking, that this money got there. So we shouldn't forget all of that at the same time as there's this, you know, huge public outcry. But keep in mind that, you know, even though there is this outcry and several politicians try to pass legislation against Saudi Arabia, at the end of the day, this is about oil. And no matter what Saudi Arabia does, they've got to continue to have this relationship with that country and with that government.
And although this isn't in your piece, I believe Israel also used Islamists as an alternative to the secular nationalists and radicals of the PLO, right?
Absolutely. the strategy of using Islamists against secular nationalists and against, you know, the left communist parties and so on and so forth is largely a U.S. strategy, right? It gets used in country after country, Egypt, Iran, and then, of course, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Israel, of course, you know, takes several pages from the strategy and courts the precursor to Hamas. Hamas comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, and Israel, of course, would rather support them. And they give them various concessions, you know, including the ability to set up institutions and function legally. They also, you know, turn the other way when there's a project to build a large number of mosques, which then becomes sort of the place where the Islamists can recruit people to their cause, et cetera, et cetera. So absolutely, Israel, too, taking a page from the United States, sees the Islamists as, if you will, a bulwark against the secular nationalists, in this case, the PLO.
And let's close this by looking at the very recent past of the remarkable uprisings across the Middle East over the last several months. What kind of role have Islamists played in those, if any?
In Egypt, you know, there was initially at least a hue and cry around the Muslim Brotherhood. And from Mubarak, you got the line, which is a line that, you know, the dictators of various countries will have used and will continue to use, which is you either keep us or you're going to get the Islamists. You're going to get Iran, right, which is the fear-mongering. And Israel picked this up very quickly. So you had all sorts of fear-mongering from Israeli sources saying that, you know, the U.S. Has got to support Mubarak. Some people even argue that the U.S. has got to support Mubarak or we will have the Muslim Brotherhood come to power and so forth. But if you look on the ground, the Muslim Brotherhood actually did not initiate the January 25th demonstration in Egypt and, in fact, stayed away for the first few days. They got in on the action only a couple of days later, and that's only because there's a generational shift, a split, if you will, in the Muslim Brotherhood. There are the older, more conservative forces who I'll talk about shortly, and then there are the younger people in the group who are more attracted to the kind of, you know, demonstrations from below and movements from below kind of strategies. And so these folks put enough pressure on the leadership so that they actually got involved. And in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood actually did play an important role. But they're one among several political organizations that have been a part of the Egyptian revolution. And therefore, to see them as, you know, you either have Mubarak or the Muslim Brotherhood would actually be wrong, even though in the upcoming elections, it's likely people are predicting that they'll get between 20 and 30% of the vote. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is actually, you know, an interesting example of how moderate Islamists, you know, there is a division and has been for at least the last two decades between the moderates and the extremists, you know, the people who are called the jihadis, the Salafis, and so forth. And the thing about the leadership, the conservative leadership, the older generation of the Muslim Brotherhood, is what we've seen is since January 25th is they're willing to contort themselves in all sorts of ways to seem acceptable to everyone. And this is not surprising because almost all parties that want to win an election will do that in order to get everybody's approval. So even though sections in the U.S. establishment, the more right-wing sections, as well as Fox News, Glenn Beck, for instance, has been screaming bloody murder about the Muslim Brotherhood and so on, I think what we can expect to see is that they're going to take a rather pragmatic approach, particularly the leadership. They do recognize that their base, you know, does not want to continue to have the same sort of peace agreement with Israel in light of the atrocities that Israel commits on Palestinians. But at the same time, pragmatically speaking, from their point of view, they also see that the $2 billion in aid that comes from the United States rests upon this 1979 peace treaty that was made. So I think that they're going to be ready to shift and shape and do all sorts of things in order to have a power-sharing agreement with the army. And it sounds like in the U.S. there are also sections of political elite who might be willing to do that. So the Brookings Institution has written a piece called Don't Fear the Muslim Brotherhood. Less right-wing, let us say, and more centrist media figures like Anderson Cooper, Fareed Zakaria, and so on, have carried the same sort of line, saying, don't fear them. They are like the AKP in Turkey, which, you know, the AKP in Turkey is a part of NATO. They're very enthusiastic, or at least used to be very enthusiastic, about being a part of the EU, which means accommodating all of the neoliberal agenda that comes from the European context. So at the end of the day, this is a moderate Islamist party that will do whatever it needs to, I think, in the months to come to try to gain power.
The Iranian revolution, though, was a very polyglot thing at first. There were a lot of leftists and seculars involved, and then the Islamists came out on top and jailed all their former comrades. Do you see any reason to expect something like a rerun of that in Egypt?
No, I don't think so. I think some of the reports that I have heard from activists on the ground in Egypt, for instance, at a demonstration in Alexandria, one of the Muslim Brotherhood representatives who was speaking in front of the rally came forward and said, you know, he said various sectarian things. He said, we would like to create an Islamic state and this and that. And he got booed. He got literally booed and, you know, kicked out of the stage and so forth. So in other words, the movement that's taking place right now in Egypt and in elsewhere and so on is profoundly democratic, but it's also secular. And you've seen that in the images, you know, the demonstrations in Tahrir Square, Muslims praying while their Christian brothers and sisters guard them, similarly Christians praying and so forth. So in that kind of climate, it is very difficult for the Muslim Brotherhood, particularly if it wants to hold on to its sectarian politics, to try to usurp control in the way that Khomeini did when he came back from Paris after the 1979 revolution. It's true that in Iran there were various forces, leftists, students, workers, and so forth. But keep in mind that the left was badly weakened by the U.S. and by its interference in the region. The Tudeh Party had, you know, had been it became a shadow of itself and so forth. And the problem is that in the absence of an organized left, the Islamists were able to, particularly Khomeini and his party, were able to make political hay. Today, some 30 years later, there is a historical memory among people as to how this happened, what happened, etc. And the Green Movement, certainly in Iran, is exposing the dissatisfaction that people have with the current Islamist party in power and the way they operate. So it is unlikely that people will accept this sort of alternative in the same way that they were willing to do so, because they simply didn't have this example before.
That was Deepa Kumar, professor of media studies at Rutgers. You can find her article on the topic on the International Socialist Review's website, isreview.org. That's isreview.org. As I said earlier, it's well worth reading. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. That was some of Split Enz doing Bold as Brass. More music from New Zealand, that from 1977. And you will not now have to listen to 20 minutes of me asking for your money. To support KPFA, I will just cut that down to about 30 seconds. If you like what you hear, if you like Behind the News, if you listen on the web or via podcast, and you would like to keep these broadcasts coming, please make a pledge to kpfa.org and keep this experiment in community broadcasting going for another six decades. That's kpfa.org. Click on the donate button. If you like Behind the News, please do consider contributing to kpfa.org. That's it for me. I'll be back soon. Bye.